Thanks for tuning in to Breaking Ground. This series is produced on behalf of the Ground Forum and Ground Engineering magazine and is the UK's most popular geotechnical and ground engineering podcast. We're now supported by GeoFM, so let's hear a message from them before we meet our guests.
Hi there. Sorry to interrupt. A quick question. What do you get when you combine ground engineering and satellite remote sensing expertise? The answer is GeoFM, where satellite data means your technical insight. Why not ask us a question at geofm.com?
I'm on the road again with the Breaking Ground podcast. I'm Steve Hadley, and I'm joined today at the offices of Mott MacDonald in London by Hock Lu, technical director from Mott MacDonald, and Javier Marti, who's flown in all the way from Barcelona on behalf of Geotechnical Observations. And I believe you were both at the Smart Geotechnics conference in London yesterday. I hope you enjoyed the experience. I know, Hock, you were talking and presented.
Yes.
On which topic?
On the oxygen matter.
Excellent. Which is, of course, what we're going to be talking about here today. Can you, for the benefit of our listeners, just explain why we have this need for the observational method, first of all?
Sure.
And just the very basic premise of,
understand,
of what it is.
So, yeah, let's start with how this ideas of the observational method came up. It started by the father of soil mechanics, Karl Dazarki, sometime in 1945. As you know, that Karl Dazarki did work a lot of consultancy projects, even though he's a professor. But one thing that he found that every time he worked on a project, a new problem come up. So there's not a single formula that he can solve the ground soil mechanics or ground engineering problems. So what he came up with the idea is, okay, about this idea also the observational method. Basically, what I'm trying to say is you allow the design to be modified as construction progresses by observing the response of the ground and the structures. So by doing that, he emphasized the importance of field observation and field measurements. That's the key difference, the observational method and the conventional design.
I suppose in a sense, it's where construction started. You build something, if it falls down, don't do it that way again, do it a different way. But hopefully it doesn't actually get to the point of ultimate failure. And so with the sophistication that we got now and the monitoring that we're going to go on to talk about, you're actually able to interject in that process and adjust props and construction sequences and so on.
I think more than if it doesn't fall out, is more if you see how things are behaving while you're implementing it. I think before, when Terzaghi and Peck were alive, the designs were being done by fewer people, and they were implementing that design as well. So they not only understood what the calculations were and which were their starting thoughts on the ground, they will see as well how that ground evolved. And so they were able to implement those changes quickly. But then the industry changed. We all became more specialized, more contractual. And that's when I think the idea of the observational method started fading away a little bit.
Yes, I think that's key, just to chip in, because if you read Professor Peck's Nine Ranking Lecture in 1969, one of the things that he mentioned is for the implementation of the observational method to be successful, you need a control mind. And that person must have authority to decide and to make a call during construction for the change in the design.
Okay. So the term, the observational method, that was coined by Peck, was it back in the 60s?
It started from 1945, but after that, all the principles, the procedures is laid out by Professor Peck in 1969 in his Nine Ranking Lectures.
So Peck was working for Terzaghi, with Terzaghi.
Right.
So
Correct.
They basically... Terzaghi was, I think, probably the mastermind, but Peck was, I don't know, the closest thing to the mastermind.
He's Terzaghi's student.
Right. And where were they based? Were they
in from the? They're based in the States, but from University of Illinois.
Yeah.
Right. Excellent. Okay, so they started looking at the use of instrumentation as part of their thesis, or
well, because the observation was necessary for the method. they needed instruments in order to be able to understand how the ground was behaving, how the structures were behaving while the design was being implemented, and that's where instrumentation. But instruments, I mean, they come a long way. The Egyptians mm-hmm. already did the surveying, so this is the. I mean, another character important in measurements is Lord Kelvin. No,
sure.
He always said, "What you can measure, you can improve." So again, it's measurement is yes critical.
Okay, and let's talk a little bit more about some of the methodology. So the observational method, it's included in Eurocode 7. There's reference to it within the Manual of Geotechnical Engineering, which is a book that I often reference on this podcast, and it's an absolute mine of information. And in fact, the chapter within the Manual of Geotechnical Engineering on the observational method was actually written by Dinesh, who was the subject of the last podcast. So it nicely flows on from his two episodes. So there, it's kind of split into two approaches. Hock, can you kind of explain the two main approaches and how they would work?
Sure. Come back to, let's remind ourselves again, what is the observational method? As I said earlier, the OOM is kidding is you allow for the design to be modified during constructions. This is the key difference compared to traditional design.
Yeah.
Because in a traditional design, if you follow the traditional contract, as a designer, you produce a design, you pass to the contractor, and you just build it. So what this OOM, the key principle is, they link between design and construction and provide a feedback loop where the field measurements came in, because you can use this data not only just to validate or confirm your design, which often quite conservative in a traditional approach, but you use this data feedback to your design so that you can improve it and optimize your design as construction progresses.
Mm-hmm. You could look at it from the beginning with the idea of making savings on your propping system, for instance. So you could take more optimistic values or realistic values, should we say, at the start. So you would carry out a design based on optimistic values, and then have a strategy to introduce props if the movements of the wall, and this is where the instrumentation comes in, if the movements of the wall are too great. The other approach would be to look at it in terms of you take more conservative values, and if the wall is behaving really well, because it is, let's face it, it's predominantly walls that we're talking about here. You know, it does this philosophy of the observational method, it doesn't really work in terms of sort of bearing piles, because you can't really respond to that because the building's already up. So I think we're talking about walls. I don't even think we're really talking about slopes, are we?
We can. In fact, because the observational method can be applied to any geotechnical problems.
Right.
In fact, in his ranking, the lecture presented by Peck, they illustrate many cases three, like environment, panels, even building damage assessment or any underpinning work they need to do to existing buildings. But the key thing is why there are a lot of case study on the retaining wall by omitting steel props, because that is the most obvious one way we can create a lot of major cost and time and program savings, even carbon savings. So,
That's what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's face it. There's no point spending all this time on the technology if there's not going to be a financial benefit, and obviously from the safety aspects of it as well. But you know, the key driver for the utilization of this equipment will be financial.
And I think the savings are huge, because I mean, how Mott McDonald's is implementing it right now, because of the contractual constraints, is we have a conservative design, but we know it can be implemented faster. Yeah. It doesn't require the probes. We still have the probes there, so you've already spent to have them built.
Yeah.
You just don't install them, or maybe you will do the excavation faster.
Yeah. Yes.
Because you know.
Okay.
So it's not only on walls as well on embankments, as Hulk was saying, and the savings of not having to have the team excavating or to replace the team. Savings of 2 weeks' time when 500,000 will be for one day has a huge impact.
Well, let's just paint a picture in the listener's mind and say we're talking about a deep basement. Let's say a 15-meter deep basement with a diaphragm wall. And really what we're looking at is how this is going to change the construction sequence and the propping regime. So when it comes to the design process, Hulk, how does it affect your choice of parameters? And when we're comparing characteristic values with more realistic values, is it a simple divide by a certain number? How do you come up with those characteristic values? Can you just talk us through the process of design and what you as a designer require from any sort of monitoring and instrumentation regime that's put in place in order to provide you with the information to determine the trigger points and so on?
Sure. I think for the OEM design, unlike traditional design, the set of parameters that we use for the OEM design, we call the most probable parameters. Not only for the ground parameters, but also the groundwater level.
Okay.
Which is key, one of the key parameters in a deep basement design. So within what we think is the actual conditions on site. So we use these parameters, not only these two, and also the construction loading. So we need to understand the construction methodology. What as a designer, what they can foresee, or the how they're gonna build the structure. And then we simulate it and design it as close as possible to the actual conditions. Of course, by doing that, as you mentioned, in the Eurocode, then in the traditional design, then you need to allow certain safety factor. But to manage that kind of risk, what the key thing in the OEM design is, the designer must have in mind a plan of actions in for any unfavorable situations. So to do that, then you need to have a concession with the contractor. Okay, for this plan of actions, in a situation, if let's say the ground is not as good as what we think, for example, or the water level is not as what we saw, then we need to implement a pre-agreed contingency measures, and that's key. Is how we manage that risk.
Okay.
So
with you mentioned there about the water table, which obviously is really crucial. It can make such a difference in terms of the forces involved and the movements. So with the more conservative approach that you might implement and taking characteristics, would you actually assume groundwater right to the top? What's the guidance within the Eurocode?
Yeah, in the current Eurocode, for any traditional design, they say you have to design to I can't remember exactly what you say, but I think what you think, for example, during construction, what is the worst? What is the water level that you think it can happen during that time, rather than based on what is really actually on site, measure on site at the moment?
Yeah. Because so often, I think we see within ground investigation reports that water levels, and we refer to it as a water table, but a lot of the time it's actually perch water, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's not going to have the same effect in terms of the forces involved as the actual groundwater table. It does strike me, are we doing all this because of a lack of understanding about the ground? Is the observational method almost a substitute for a poor site investigation report?
No, I won't say that because the way I see it, the observation method is a way of managing these uncertainties in the ground. But not only in the ground, but the structures. I think often we forget about the structures. And all the uncertainties allow the construction sites.
Yeah.
I think maybe many times we think that ground is a continuous method, a continuous... But it's not. It changes very quickly. Mm. And when we do ground investigation, despite how intense that is, it's a small borehole. When you are doing a 300-meter retaining wall, ground, I mean, a small borehole is not representative.
Yeah.
So that's why the design has to be a starting point.
Sure.
And then, as Huck was saying, you forecast what will be the movement of the ground and the structures with that starting point. But then once you start implementing it, if it doesn't move as you expect, then that's because the ground wasn't well defined. And this is where the opportunity comes.
Yeah.
With the observational method and the right software, you can perform that back analysis with the data in order to improve those parameters like cohesion and I mean
your or stiffness. Exactly. That's correct. Mm. Because there's so many uncertainties, but it's key thing is through this back analysis using software on field observation, the key thing as a designer is you need to identify which parameter is the most influential parameters that control the behavior.
Interesting you mentioned stiffness there, because you know, you could have a great site investigation in terms of the, lots of SPT test data, triaxial data, which helps us about the strength of the ground, but doesn't necessarily tell us directly about the stiffness of the ground and how that's going to respond in terms of movement in relation to changes in movement. So there is obviously a gap in knowledge, no matter how good your ground investigation is. We do have lots of different models. You've kindly put on the screen for there some of the models, Marty. I know the listeners can't see those. We haven't quite got to the stage of doing a visual recording of these podcasts yet. Maybe that's one for the future. But we're talking about different constitutive models. Is there any particular soil models, Hock, that need to be used with the observational technique?
Yeah, I think in the OM, until you, the first step is once you identify the most influential parameters, then you need to think about what quantitative model you want to use. But regardless that, I think we should start something simpler first, like more column. Most of the time, more column can do the job because the more advance your quantitative models, you require more parameters.
Okay.
And it just made the whole process is very, very complicated because bear that in mind, the OM can only work if all these things can done very quickly because the decision need to be made is during construction. There are a lot of time pressure, so a lot of things need to be done in a very timely manner.
Yeah. So we've come up with our soil model. Let's say we're going down the approach of, well, it doesn't really matter, but let's say that the sort of more characteristic approach and potentially looking at taking props out. How do we set our trigger levels? How do we understand that, okay, that's actually moved too much, we can't take the props out? Because, you know, we've all seen it on slopes when you go around. You don't have to be an engineer to see this. A slope might be standing there next to the sea for years and it almost vertical, and then all of a sudden it's gone.
Yes.
So how can we understand at which point the movement becomes too much for us to make an intervention?
Okay, that's a good point. So in, during the design, normally we use a traffic light system to set the trigger levels, like green, amber, and red. So normally, for me, as a starting point, I see what's my red limit. The red limit is for example, taking the deep basement wall, for example, where the wall, if you hit the limit, you may think that my wall gonna start to crack like a lot, or it doesn't meet the core capacities of the wall. So from that, you walk backward. Let's say the second backward is the your amber triggers. So then you walk back, what's your green limit or green triggers? So for that amber is where normally we, as a designer, we set a certain margin between amber and red. Why? Amber usually is a point where if the wall movement hit your amber level, there's a risk reduction, meeting need to be on site. Is there anything you need to do? Mm. Any measure we need to put in to control the wall movement from moving towards the red?
Yeah. But so, how quick, you got to be careful, because if it's moved X amount, I don't know, let's say the defined limit of the wall movement is 30 mil. Because beyond 30 mil, the building next door is going to have structural issues. Now, initially, the walls move 10 mil. Okay, everyone's comfortable with that. It's in the green zone. But suddenly it starts getting up to 15, but how quickly can that move? How responsive in the case that you're going for a most probable approach and looking at sticking in some propping system quite rapidly?
Understand.
How quickly can that move? And you know, you're literally going to have to get these things up in a day.
Yeah,
I think The base of the observational method on how it's approached now, the prop will be there. You are not removing props, because that will be a double effort, installing it and removing it. That's not a saving. So you start by the most conservative approach. You install all the props, and it's only if the ground is not moving as much as you were expecting that then you won't install the next ones. And that's where the saving comes. You don't have the teams to, you don't have to stop the excavation. You don't have to put teams to install the props. And then you don't have to remove the props if they are temporal.
Yes.
I think that is...
This is another way of doing the OM, because as you can see, there's no one single way to apply this approach. What Javier mentioned earlier is an approach that developed by McDonald's, where we call it progressive modification.
Yeah.
We start something like that first. For example, we install let's say you have a long linear structure, we have the steel prop in place, for example. Then we learn the ground. We think that with the next one, we don't need it, so we don't do it. So what we call it, progressive design modifications. But there's another way you can start from the beginning, like what I said earlier, you start with most probable parameters, with a pre-agreed contingent measure, you still can do it. But to answer your question about the triggers, but good thing is, but one thing I would like to say is the OM is not suitable for a project that was a breather failure.
Okay, right. And what sort of situations might that be? Where would we see a brittle failure? Is there one type of ground conditions? Would clay be more likely to all of a sudden change from a undrained to a drained situation, perhaps?
Normally, they want to cut sometimes. Luckily, most of the problems that we are dealing with, they are quite ductile, like foundations, for even the for deep basement design, because the wall movement, it won't behave like, you know, suddenly for today and tomorrow, there's a big jump. So one thing that we normally, when we control the wall movement or the trigger levels, not only look at the magnitude, we also look at the trend. we measure, monitor the trend.
Okay.
So to answer that question about what example in the breeder failure is quite difficult because it depends on a lot of parameters and variables in the ground. You know what I mean? So we really need to understand what is the risk associated. That's why one thing I said earlier, one of the key requirements for this OM to work, the designer must have in mind what the plan of actions for any unfavorable situations.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't do that, then you should not implement OM.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And actually, this is what Peck used to say. No, you will have different scenarios, conservative, normal, and optimistic one.
Yeah.
And different routes of actions depending on what's that.
Yeah. Well, what I'm trying to understand is where we're going to see the benefits from it. You know, we spoke about the financial case earlier. In what scenarios typically are we seeing a good return on the investment? Could you give me examples in terms of soil conditions, basement depths, so our listeners can say, yeah, this might be a project that I want to give Hock a call about because I could actually see a financial benefit. Can you give us some examples?
Sure. The biggest benefit in OM, apart from this carbon savings and also this, of course, improved safety on site by promoting all these cross-working relationship and single team mentality from different parties, is the key saving is in program.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, most of the starting point, a lot of designer, they start with a quite conservative approach in the design.
But specifically in terms of the examples of situations where you've seen it in use and there's been a benefit, what sort of basement depths are we talking
about? The mortgage shaft, for instance.
So just, for example, the Crossrail mortgage shaft that I am heavily involved.
40 meters, 50 meters.
That one is talking about 40 meter deep.
Yeah.
Shaft. The shaft is not a circular shaft. It's quite a irregular polygon shaped shaft. It's one of the deepest shafts in central London.
So and that was a diaphragm wall.
Yes. It's a diaphragm wall. So the interesting about that shaft is that the start of the project at the beginning already delayed by 11 months.
Okay.
So when we set down how we're going to, you know, to mitigate that problem, one thing we came up with is using this shortening method.
Yeah.
So to cut the story short, at the end, we managed to omit all the temporary steel props. Not only we can mitigate the 11 months potential delay, but the base slab was cast 3 weeks earlier.
Okay.
Than original program.
Yeah. And the ground there, I guess it was a mixture of conditions. You've got some river terrace deposits over clay and then planets.
London clay and then lumber group and then be involved with planet, yeah.
Okay.
Majority of excavation is in London clay and lumber group.
Yeah, okay. And what else have you seen, Javier, in terms of the use of this type of method? What other sorts of conditions?
I think in general terms now it's mostly used on the shaft, really.
For example, to talk about Mott's point of view is that currently, of course, I'm doing on this high-speed 2-phase-1 assets and also on excavations. But in Mott's case, we also did it in the Heathrow as well. That one also for excavations.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We also had some experience in some of the environment job in the ground improvement as well.
The Heath trial was an interesting one because it was a trial. So they were able to test a certain area of I'm not the best expert of a very plastic clay with enough time in order to influence the design. And of course that has huge value, and this is something that should be done more often, no? To trial different grounds, especially because this is in the middle of nowhere, so there is not enough experience in the industry to understand really well how that was going to be behaving. So if you can do that trial and understand better the ground to extrapolate in your design, that has a huge saving value for the project.
Was that an extension to the district line?
No, this is high speed 2, actually.
Oh, sorry, I thought you meant the Heathrow.
No, the Boddington Heathrow.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. And What about rock? Does it have a role to play within, let's say, sort of softer rocks?
Yes, definitely. For example, high speed two, most of them are sitting on weak rock.
The
mudstone type. We apply it on one of the portal structure. In high speed two, they're all sitting on the weak rock mudstone, where we won the ground engineering awards and the ground engineering editors award this year.
But let's focus on the soils and look at that case study of, you said Moorgate.
Moorgate Shaft.
So what was the instrumentation regime on that scheme? We spoke earlier about the importance of groundwater levels. So presumably bathymeters.
Yes. For Crossroad Moorgate Shaft, because of this location sitting in the highly confined urban area. So the most influential parameters that we want to look at is the stiffness of the ground, because the stiffness of the ground, they really control the movement of the wall, because they really control the design is the movement of the wall. So the primary instruments for that project, it was wall inclinometers.
Okay.
We actually installed shape arrays there.
And shape arrays, yeah.
Sorry, I'm not shape familiar arrays, with that. Shape away.
Shape arrays. They are chains of MEMS sensors that are built up together. I believe in here there were 500 millimeter segments.
Right.
It's like one automatic chain that provides the wall deflection. In this case, because they are installed vertically.
Yeah.
It's like if you have a lot of tilmeters that were linked together.
Yeah.
So once you've installed them, you can take readings automatically almost as often as you want. I think in here, they were using hourly readings. The precision accuracy of the system is fantastic. But I think what is the best thing is...
That's measuring what?
Deflection.
Deflection.
Wall deflection.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're putting these... behind the diaphragm wall.
Inside.
In the diaphragm wall.
Probably, I mean, the smart thing will be to do both, really, because you cannot guarantee that the behavior of the ground is going to be the same as the wall.
Spoken like a true salesman there.
If I was to choose, probably I will install like sensometers in the ground behind the wall. Alongside some inclinometer as well, or shape array. But the shape array was critical because it performs really well. And the fact that you have 500 millimeter segments, it gives you a lot of definition.
Right.
So, because you want to characterize the ground as best as possible, that is.
So, let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of those inclinometers. So, you're putting it within the diaphragm wall, presumably before the concrete's been poured, you're dropping it to be a plastic tube within the reinforcement, and then do you have to backfill that tube at all, or you've got a probe which presumably tells the device exactly what direction it's moving and how much it's moving. That can that go in and out on?
You have different approaches, but
okay.
So yeah, you put the reinforcement in, and within the reinforcements you have a negative. It could be the regular 70 millimeter inclinometer casing or 50 millimeter tube. I think the external diameter of the shaper is 29 or 26 millimeters. That is then all grouted, and you have the wall.
Right.
Once everything has been grouted, you can assume that the casing is going to behave as the wall because it is embedded in within the grout. The approach of using an instrument like the shaper is that you want to have continuous monitoring. You don't want to have someone going over there to read every time.
No.
It takes away as well the human error factor, which is usually the biggest error that you can have. So you install something that is going to be there for the entire duration of the project. It could be even used for performance of the shaft after the project has been delivered, if you want.
Yeah.
And that gives you, yeah, so once you install it, you don't touch it, just collect data. And that is the data that the designer will use to perform their back analysis.
Okay. So the trigger levels in terms of reaction, they've already been set up. So you're connecting the inclinometer to a computer, real-time information, because you're saying it's staying in there all the time. And the computer is intelligent enough to presumably react to the speed of movement and maybe send an alert to...
Yeah, I will say there is one term I always have issues with. I don't like the word real-time. Okay. Real-time means that you're taking a reading and someone is looking at that, like that, yeah. And immediately. That it happens on dynamic monitoring sometimes.
Right.
I've done it, and I mean, like... 48-hour shift, so you have someone attached to a laptop looking at things because you know that if something moves, you have to run.
Do you know what? they started introducing monitoring on that we could see a live stream of on power load tests a few years ago.
Yeah, that's it.
And I thought this is a great idea. be able to understand exactly what's going on. And I think at the beginning, it's good. But it's so stressful. Exactly. I ended up spending all night watching it. There's nothing I can do anyway. It'll behave however it behaves.
Most part of the times, you don't need to be there on real time. You need to have automatic monitoring because there is value on having... There's so many parameters that can affect a structure. Isolation, variations in temperature. The ground is moving all the time. There are variations that are more than 2 millimeters, which is... a requirement on many projects that you shouldn't exceed for a period of time. The ground moves and the building's width, everything is moving. So automatic monitoring provides value in terms of understanding better what's the natural behavior of things.
Yeah.
So when something that is not natural happens, you can see it, you can detect. That's when we cut... the anchors, and you can see suddenly a release of stress and movement in the wall.
Yeah.
Now, that is where the value of automatic monitoring relies on.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of the kind of communication within the management team, between the contractor and the instrumentation specialist and the consultant? Because it's all well and good having this information and you're getting... the feedback, but if nobody is acting on it, then it's really a waste. Maybe you could provide some good examples of when it's been particularly effective, and perhaps without naming any names, when it's not gone quite so well.
I think it's been a long time, but there is one project where this was critical, the Heathrow accident, where there was data, people were looking at it, but they were not able to react on it. I think...
Yeah, this is the NATM...
But it wasn't... Yeah, it wasn't because of the construction procedure. It was because on how the organization worked. The tunneling procedure is really safe. I know the change has... The name has changed here. But
what's it called now? Then
but in Spain it's still
spray concrete.
New Austrian tunneling method. Which basically meant that you would dig the tunnel and spray and then kind of move along. So which really sped up construction, but it did mean that it was introducing risk. So, I can't remember. I think there might have been a couple of fatalities in that accident. Certainly, it was a big story, and we're going back 25, 30 years for this incident at Heathrow, and our listeners can Google the story. There'll be plenty of information out there, but I think that's a really example.
The information was there. The guy in charge was seeing that. I mean, he saw movement. I think the organization wasn't fit for purpose. So he wasn't able to, there was only one guy in the tunnel where three of them were supposed to be. Or I mean, I had access to the report done by the Crown.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it was amazing.
Mm.
But what failed wasn't the monitoring or the design. What failed was the organization and the contract, which is what Hawk and I are discussing all the time. It's the contract that needs to change in order to improve, which is what you are asking.
Yeah, really. I mean, what are the key things that we need to put in place to ensure that the instrumentation is used correctly, Hawk?
Yeah, the key thing is, okay, let's think about, before touch of a contract, is that what we want, because every instrument that we put in the ground or in the structure need to be properly well designed and must have a purpose or must have a question to answer what we want. And then we not only use it to do protect existing structure, of course that is very, very important, like Crossrail, we want to make sure the surrounding structure are safe and sound during construction, but also what are we going to use this data for next? Ideally, we want to use it for design, change the design during construction, where the OM come in, and also how are we going to use this data, this process data, or this highly processed and interpreted data for future use, for the optimized and then for the better to inform the ground for the in the future developments in the area or in a similar geology in a industry. So in that one, we know this is what we want from the data, then we're talking about how are we going to procure this IM specialist or contractor that can achieve that purpose.
Yeah,
so we need to look at outcome first, then we talk about how we need to procure it. Ideally, we need to be something like alliance contract type approach, or at the NEC 4 next time we get some like VE or the early contractor involvement, where all parties like IM specialist, principal contractor, the client, the designer, all other specialists sit down in the same table, or how are we going to do this, what we want to achieve.
Okay.
I think that's key.
Yeah.
I've done this in Crossrail. I mean, when I started working in this country, I did this many times. It was an integrated approach. We were all Crossrail, and I was sitting with people from Arup or from Balfabit, Morgan Sindel, and we were all had the same aim in a way.
Yeah.
So it's possible. It's just difficult. I think the problem with monitoring is that now is seen a lot like installing items, and everything is following a bill of quantities. That the knowledge is not valued there.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter if you know or not know how to install things, because the bill of quantities only values the cost. So
it seems to me that you need people that are really strong, you know, in terms of right, we're going to use that data, we're actually going to stop what we're doing, we're not going to carry on excavating, and we're going to introduce more props or backfill, whatever we need to do. I think, you know, in construction we're all against tight time schedules and budgets and so on, and understandably there might be a reluctance to say, hang on, we can't carry on with this, because, you know, there's huge personal commercial implications for making those decisions. So you've got to be really strong.
One thing, I don't remember who said this on the Smart Geotechnics yesterday. He said many times the contractor sees the monitoring as a cost, as a waste, because it can delay construction. They don't understand it's an investment, because it can improve things, or in worst case scenarios, it can detect catastrophes as well.
Yeah.
But the key thing is, if it's not well installed, it's not the right instrument, or it's not providing the right data, it's just a waste of time. And that's why there has to be value on understanding or being able to install things correctly.
Yeah. Well, we explained before about piezometers, which was looking up monitoring water level, which are a kind of key driver for the forces and the movements. Inclinometer, which is a more direct measurement of the actual movement. A couple of other ones that I know that geotechnical observations provide the extensometers and strain gauges. May be obvious to listeners what those things do, but probably not to everybody. So perhaps, Javier, you could just explain a little bit about the differences between extensometers and inclinometers and how strain gauges might work.
Okay, so extensometers mainly is to monitor the different rate of settlement of the layers on the ground, because different type of grounds might behave in a different way under drain or undrain circumstances. And that's why it's important to correlate all the different sensors as well. I mean, data alone might not be meaningful. And that's why you need to combine different instruments. Inclinometers will give you deflection over a vertical borehole. If you install it in the ground, you understand how the ground is behaving. If you install it in a structure, you will understand how that structure is behaving. An inclinometer in a structure could be similar to a tiltmeter. Doesn't provide the same information. A tiltmeter is just one tiny point of that structure. It's not representative most part of the times.
Yeah. And the strain gauges would you put them, let's say, next to the capping beam or the whaling beam, or do they sit within the middle of if the listeners can imagine a horizontal prop from one side of an excavation to another, where would they sit within that?
I think sometimes there is a confusion, understanding confusion between a crack meter or a potentiometer and a strain gauge.
Yeah.
You can have strain gauges very specific for props to understand how the prop is behaving towards an effort, a force. No?
Yeah.
And they are very, very small.
Okay.
And you can't really define, if you have a circle or prop, the entire behavior of that prop.
Mm.
And then you have crack meters, which are to monitor the displacement over a joint or a crack, if you want. It's true the mechanism of the monitor system is similar, in a which, I mean, it could be a vibrating wire or... So there is some terminology over there. I think, probably a capping beam will be a good place where to install a crack meter to understand that behavior.
Just want to add on that one. There's a danger that you install strain gauges in a concrete beam or whatever. The reason, because strain gauges, they measure strain. You won't know what is the force until you know what is the stiffness.
Yeah.
And this highly variable, depends on the mix and also subject to temperature.
Okay.
So
this is
it's important that we just don't think our strain gauges, we need a motor force, we install anyway. That's why I come back to what I said earlier. What we want, what's the purpose of this instrument is very important. Don't just install it.
This is why the designer and the monitoring experts need to work close together, because they see a different world than we do. We understand complementary things, I guess. So the early engagement between consultants and monitoring experts is critical for a good design of the monitoring requirements and the application of the observational method afterwards.
Yeah. I totally agree. Just to add on that one, because based on my experience, any instrument not installed properly from the beginning, no matter what you do later on, it's not going to help. All the data are rubbish.
And without wanting to throw any stones to anyone, usually monitoring contractors, they are underneath the principal contractor, which has a different aim, let's say. The information at the beginning of the project, the monitoring information, is most valued by the designer, not by the principal contractor. There is value in monitoring for the principal contractor for them to understand their construction method and fine-tune it. But ultimately, at the beginning, at the early stage of the contract, the design is what is going to have a bigger impact in the cost. So there will be sensible that at the beginning of the contract, the monitoring contractor works closer to the designer and not under the principal contractor. The designer or the client, in a way that will make sense either. I've been in contracts where there was a monitoring contractor underneath the client and the designer, and another monitoring contractor working with the principal contractor, because the client is concerned about damaging assets, especially in heavily urbanized areas. The designer will be interested on improving the design, and the contractor will be interested on improving their construction procedure or methods. They are all complementary things, but they are not the same thing. So, and again, that's one of the topics that Hawk and I talk a lot, and that we think they are a bit overlooked by the industry right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. And you would have a suite of these techniques, these devices to inform your monitoring and decision making. Can we talk a little bit about artificial intelligence? Because it seems to be playing a bigger and bigger part in our world in all sorts of different ways. I was even listening to an article about, I think it was a Van Gogh exhibition this week in Paris, where you could ask a virtual reality Van Gogh what his favourite painting was and how he got the ideas. And it just struck me like the power of machines now. So what role does AI have to play?
For the overall point of view, I think the two points I just want to make is we cannot ignore AI, because it's there, but clearly how are we going to make use of this technology in civil engineering? To our own perspective, as I mentioned earlier, the one of the key ingredients to make this to be successful is time. So to me, AI can help us with that, because AI can collect a lot of data. The more data through machine learning, they can learn, and then they can provide this information either through back analysis or any other things. And then you help do the designer to make quick decision or make more informed decisions. That's one thing. But one thing I just want to mention is that all these things, there's a limitation. Engineering judgment at the end play a most important role, because OM, you talk about engineering judgment. Otherwise, we let the machine do everything, like what Jamie said in the smart job that is yesterday. We cannot allow that. It will be very, very dangerous. We cannot rely on technology. We need to control the technology. We need the technology to help us. And then through our engineering judgment, then we can make this thing forward.
But I think, how you use your software, it makes sense, because, algorithms, it's a way of artificial intelligence, and the approach that you use it is you use the algorithm to analyze the most probable causes. And then you have an engineer that will be able to see, to look at these outcomes, understand what makes more sense within the ground that you have. Hmm. So I think there is, at the very least from my point of view, Mott MacDonald, how you are working right now, there is a really good use of artificial intelligence to assist the engineer to be able to make the better judgment in the least time possible. Where before it will take months of one engineer fiddling with the parameters little by little to see if it will fit the movement that they were having, now you can do it in hours.
Yes. Just to summarize, just remember that our SIC president mentioned that what's the definition of productivity? there are two things: efficient and effectiveness. Efficiency and effectiveness. To me, AI can help you with the efficiency, but if the effectiveness part, it have to come from engineers.
Yeah. And the data has to be good.
Yes. Yes. Otherwise, the AI will collect all the rubbish data. Engineer made the wrong
information. More confused. Again, installing the right instrument in the right way is critical for that to be useful.
Thanks. Well, it's been really fascinating. I think maybe we could just close this out with some final thoughts, maybe some recommendations to our listeners for places to go and find out more about this topic. Hock, I'll come to you first.
Yeah, sure. I believe we all did say that, what can the engineers, especially civil engineers, do in climate change? To me, as a designer, we need to sort out the problem of over-conservatism in geotechnics. We need to produce a lean design, and OM is the starting point.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I entirely agree with that approach. I think that the other thing that is important is, as an industry or community, we need to be able to collaborate more in the spirit of the NEC. That's not something that we see really in our day-to-day. And the early engagement with experts. So you engage with a consultant, the monitoring industry, we provide a different view. And if we all work together from the beginning, the delivery is much better.
Great. Well, I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more about it in the future. Maybe not on HS2, but there'll be other schemes. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Hi again, I'm Ifeanya from GeoFM, and if you like Breaking Ground, chances are you'll also enjoy my vlog, IM News, bringing you the very latest in infrastructure asset management with a geotechnical focus. Visit geofm.com to tune in.